is BPN Radio, your 24-hour internet prayer station, calling America to pray. It's time now for the Christian War Room with your host, Michael Schonborn. Now, here's Michael.
Yeah, thank you, Dale, for the introduction, and welcome to the Christian War Room. We are back on our subject, and the subject is 100 ways to kill the theory of evolution. So we are back on the old subject. I think last time we finished off with telepathy and miracles, and we probably talked about the presence of angels. And I think this was number 71. We did talk about the concept of love, which doesn't, and compassion, which doesn't fit in with the theory of evolution. So if you've got somebody who is weak and cannot look after themselves, according to the survival of the fittest, it makes sense to just, kill that person rather than to support this and to risk your own life as well. But it doesn't sort of fit in, the same as, and we've seen it in war, heroic actions where people risk their own lives to the point of self-destruction or almost assured self-destruction to make sure that somebody else gets rescued, that somebody else is so okay. And again, this is all stuff which doesn't fit into the concept of the theory of evolution. So we need to bear this in mind. And I would say that love, or the presence of love, the presence of selfless love, and I'm not talking about erotic love, which an evolutionist might argue is there for the for procreation and for ensuring the continuation of the species. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about selfless love, which ultimately leads you to possibly even self-destruction, where you give up your life for somebody else. And I mean, it's real. It's heard of, and it's been happening. So, doesn't fit in. Doesn't fit in at all. Okay, we are on number 72 for killing the theory of evolution. And again, I'm sort of digressing a little bit, and I'm not really trying to make a scientific argument, but I'm trying to make you think. If you've got doubts about the theory of evolution, but one of the things the naturalists are telling us is that everything is about the survival of the fittest. It's about hanging in there as long as possible and dodging death and making sure that the next generation is there, and that this is the mechanism that keeps us going. And yet when we just observe human life, it just doesn't fit in. We've got a whole lot more, yeah, which doesn't make any sense from an evolutionary point of view. And one of the things, and this is number 72, is literature, poetry, writing, and communication. And communication, we're going to maybe look at communication later, but literature, poetry, and writing in itself. So what is the purpose of any of these things? And again, from an evolutionary process, it doesn't make any sense whatsoever. We look at literature for entertainment, for a poetry is just to have beautiful language, maybe making a point or communicating something beautiful. And even again, when we just look at the concept of beauty, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't fit into an evolutionary context to some extent. A naturalist would say, okay, beauty is there, for the bee to go to the pretty flower and all that. But for us, what is the point of appreciating a lily, or colors, in various forms or or symmetry or things like that? It doesn't fit in. It doesn't fit in. Again, what they try to make us believe is that we've got a chimpanzee, and I sometimes I'm bamboozled when I watch these nature programs. I sort of remember seeing this chimpanzee researcher, and obviously she's a naturalist. She believes in evolution, and she believes that we are closely related to chimpanzees or monkeys, and she studies them, and she studies their social structures, and see how they get on and what they're doing, and then because they use a stick and they get it taught by their by their mother to use a stick to, you know, poke in somewhere to pick up some food. So they say, oh, they use tools, and immediately the way they put it, they're on par with us. They learn to communicate, and they find out that chimpanzees, you know, using sign language, they can master a handful of words. And again, the same thing, you know, straight away the link is made, and you kind of think to yourself, sorry, what? What's going on here? Yeah. I had a friend in Africa, and he had two pigs, and he could talk to the pigs, and they pretty much understood what was going on. So if he came, you know, out of the bush, and he, you know, called the pigs, they came straight away, so they understood, they had an identity, they understood the name, and he could have a basic communication with them. And it's another aspect as well. My brother had a dog, and he had like a lot of stuffed animals, you know, like these toys, you know, stuffed toys, each one of them had a name, and he could. So my mother, she could, you know, talk to the dog and tell him to fetch so and so, and he would then, you know, run off and fetch the one with the correct name. You know? And it was a bit of a game for him, but the dog clearly could associate a word with a particular item. Obviously, he couldn't talk, and he couldn't do sign language or something, but he could make himself understood, you know, if he wanted something. So, I mean, some of the arguments which are made within, you know, from evolutionists, from naturalists about this, they are laughable to some extent, I think. And again, there's nothing in comparison and in contrast to literature. You know, the average language, and again, I'm not quite sure how close I am. I went into this some time ago. If you want to learn a language, you need about 1,000 words to be able to rudimentary communication, you know, so to, you know, let people know you're hungry, or, you know, you need some water, or where to go, or good morning, or things like that, yeah, or you've got pain, about 1,000 words, yeah, and it'll help you to survive. You won't be able to have, you know, a lot of meaningful conversations. Now, a vocabulary, an average vocabulary is about somewhere between 10 and 20,000 words. So that is the command of language an average person has. Yeah. And I'm not sure how far it goes. I mean, you might Google it, but whether the information is correct or not is a different question. But the vocabulary is probably well beyond 20,000 words. I mean, in my case, I know two languages fluently. I know about 4 or 5 languages, including the two I know fluently. So 3 more, not so fluently, but I can get by, and I'm not quite sure how many words I know in each of the languages. But I mean, the vocabulary is absolutely vast. I have at my disposal to talk about certain things, and I'm not very good at it either. There are people who master language far better than what I do, or different languages. So what point am I making here? We have got highly complex lives. We have got highly complex communication skills. We have got literature, you know, just for entertainment. So somebody thinks up a story and puts it down on paper, and somebody else reads it and they get entertained by it. We've got poetry. Yeah? Again, poetry is no point in an evolutionary context in poetry. It's just like nice words, and you digest them and you think about them, and maybe sometimes you try to, you know, praise something or elevate something. Sometimes you just, you know, it's just the beauty of the words flowing together. We do write. Yeah. Again, the skill of writing is pretty much as old as mankind. I was once going to, at a university, I didn't go in the end, but I thought it was quite interesting. It was a presentation about the switch over from oral to written communication, yeah, when people started writing. And they based it on the evidence they had when people started writing. And when you, at the time, I didn't think too much about it, but later sort of the penny dropped. When you look at when people started using the written word, It's about a couple of thousand years before Christ. You know? And then again, you think about it, you know, from a Christian perspective, what happened? We've got about 2,500, what is it? It's 3,500 BC. That's right, isn't it? 4,003. No, 2,500 BC. We had the flood, you know, and pretty much wiped everything out. So pretty much all the archaeological evidence, a lot of it is gone from that time, from that period. But then suddenly we had, you know, people being around the planet again. We had Noah and his, I'm sure Noah could write, read and write. And we had suddenly, you know, people multiplying and carrying on these skills and people being able to read and write. And we had evidence of written material from those periods. Yeah. So it does make sense. So people have been able to communicate using symbols as long as mankind exists, pretty much. Right. We've got number 73. Number 73 is a mix of languages. And it is kind of interesting when you look at the mix of languages. Also, when you look at languages today. Now, language is a very fluid thing. And it's not sort of engraved in stone. And I've seen it in my generation that when I was a kid, we were using words which later, you know, other kids or generations coming after me, they didn't use them anymore. They're different words. And there's a change within language going on all the time. But nevertheless, you can still sort of trace a lot of languages back to a common root. But also, they're fundamentally different languages where there's no commonality whatsoever. And all I need to point out is when you look at Chinese and you look at some of the German languages, you look at Slavic languages, even though obviously people got together and they shared words and a lot of words. I was surprised how many German words are in the Russian language, words which I understood because they had a German root. And then the other big group of words is Latin and Greek words you find in Slavic languages, like in Russian as well. But nevertheless, there's a huge number of words which bear no resemblance to anything you know I've heard in English, in Latin, in Greek, or any of those languages. And so, I mean, what you find is that there has been some definitive differences between different language groups, and I think language researchers or people who work in this art of trying to analyze what language is all about, they will probably identify common groups. Then again, when you go to English, yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I'm talking in English to you, but you look at English and you look at the language that's there, and you've got Germanic words, you've got Latin words, you've got Norse words in the language, so from the Vikings, and it's sort of a mix from all over, came together, and then somehow, you know, like you know, due to the empire, it suddenly is the language that's spoken all over the place. A bit like that, what Latin was in medieval days, where Latin, you know, from, you know, the first century pretty much to the 15th, maybe 16th, 17th century, was spoken all over Europe. And if you knew Latin, you could, you know, go from one part of Europe to the other and you could communicate in some means to, you know, with other academics who spoke Latin as well. Okay, right, what about evolution? Now, you would think that a couple of things, because for survival it's important to speak a common language. Maybe we have got it today, but there are sort of two school of thoughts. One of them is, you know, how does it all fit together? You know, why do we have different languages? Why is it not a common language? Also, why are there certain languages which we cannot root together, you know, that we've got, for example, Chinese, which is totally and utterly different. We've got some languages on the African continent, which, you know, there's one language we've got in Southwest Africa, which is, it's this clicking sound. Doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Doesn't compare to any of the European languages or the Far Eastern, the Asian languages, Semitic languages, or any other languages. Just doesn't fit in. Yeah. Totally and utterly different, just a clicking sound. And different clicks mean different things. And it's very hard to learn, very hard to, if you don't, you know, if you're not born with it, to speak with it. Where does it come from? There's no answers to that from an evolutionary point of view. Why do people suddenly start clicking to communicate? From a biblical point of view, the answer is very simple. Yeah, we've got the confusion of languages at the Tower of Babel. I mean, we could sort of sit down and work out, you know, what the potential population was at that time. And then people started splitting up and they went to different parts of the world because they couldn't understand one another. So, and then obviously we had a development. You might even use the term the evolution of languages, you know, depending on the level of isolation people had. You know, if they were very isolated, they would probably keep the original language. If they were mixing with other people groups, then the language got maybe somewhat diluted. You know, so in Africa, you've got things like Swahili and other languages. But again, even Swahili languages like that, they're no resemblance to anything in Europe, anything in the Middle East, or any of the other languages. So there are big questions to be asked, and some of it doesn't fit in sort of with an evolutionary context. So it's very hard to sort of squeeze it in there. We've got number 74. Oh, we talked about this. The evidence of languages about 3000 BC. That's what, you know, even scientists say, that we've got the written word and the written language and all that. And right about that time, I mean, probably about 2500, right about there, we know that that all this happened, the Tower of Babel and things like that. Number 75, the lack of human bones. We can actually create a mathematical model of population, and also when you go from an evolutionary point of view, you've got a mathematical model of how many people you would have to generate a human. And what we, I mean, this is what even Darwin said. He said he predicted, if he's right with the theory, and once you dig into the ground, that the evidence should be there, you know, the ground should be littered with human bones all over. And here's the problem. It's not. It's not littered with human bones. We don't find them. We don't find, we should find pretty much an endless variation of the skull formation and of the human bones of skeletons. And we are not. We are not finding that stuff, yeah. We are not finding that, you know, human bones all over the place, telling us or giving us, you know, this. I'm sure you've seen this image where it starts off with a little monkey and then it gradually changes to the man with the briefcase. You know, this evolutionary picture, and we haven't seen any of this. You know, they come up with all these different types and so on, and different men, and we've got the Neanderthal and things like that. I mean, even today, I mean, we find, when you look at different races throughout the planet, but they're not races in the sense of different species, they're still all humans, yeah. And so we had this Neanderthal as well, and it's interesting as well, we find Black Sea, that they were, you know, getting integrated in other populations, you know, people were marrying, you know, across the tribes and so on, and it's happening today as well, when we look at different people groups throughout the planet, and you know, there are lots of movements, migration take place, and we find that you know, people marry across races, and so, you know, certain features which may be there sometimes get diluted in certain contexts, you know, as different people groups move together. What point am I making is some of the predictions evolutionists, even Darwin, makes, they didn't materialize. Yeah. Especially, you know, as time has moved on, we've got a lot more archaeological evidence, and the evidence just doesn't tie up with what people were expecting. And again, one way to, you know, just think about the whole thing about evolution, and is maybe subject to debate, but it's certainly not looking very good for the theory of evolution when you look at the evidence around us, because the evidence doesn't tie up with what they predicted. So there's certainly lack of human bones. Mathematical population model doesn't tie up. There are also dinosaur bones, which allegedly are millions of years old, and human bones, yeah, which are a lot less old, found together in the same strata, in the same layer. Again, they don't make this public, but there's plenty of evidence around that. If you go around this one riverbed, even where I think the in Rose Valley, there was a riverbed where you could see there was some sort of lime deposit, and the lime deposit broke loose, and it freed off an ancient riverbed. And when you look in this riverbed, you can actually find, or you could find human human footsteps in the sediments and dino footsteps as well, and one human footstep inside the dino footstep. So there's obvious evidence that they were contemporary, but the scientific community doesn't take it on board because it would disturb the whole model on the theory of evolution. And again, we need to see what is really going on. And it's shocking. It's absolutely shocking that this actually took place. Yeah, that this is taking place today. That facts are just made to suit a theorem rather than the other way around. Yeah. Obviously, we get accused of this all the time. But and even though the temptation may be there, because you believe, obviously, you've got a certain model of belief, and yet, I mean, I'm fairly relaxed about my model of belief, because when I look around, everything seems to fall into place. All the evidence around me, you know, when you sort of analyze and you ask a few questions, it falls into place with my model of belief, and it doesn't with theirs. And so they get very militant about things like that. Okay, we have got about 8 minutes left. We've got a few more. We've got number 76 now, which is a cosmological approach. And there's one thing. There's a lot of theory about, you know, the creation of stars and things like that, and how the stars should come together from a Christian point of view. We know God has created all the stars, and God is pretty much limitless. So for God to create the cosmos or the universe and to create man, to go into the macro and the micro universe, it's no problem. Yeah, he just speaks a word and it is. And again, distance and time and all these things are not a problem to him. So he creates. And what we find today is what we see when we look into space is every now and then we see that a star is, you know, a star blows up, you know, there's some collision or whatever, and you've got like the supernova and the star goes. And then there's obviously the theory how stars are born, you know, that there's a bit of dust, all gets together, it's lots of gravity, suddenly some chemical reaction sets off and it pours out a lot of light as it burns up. And it's an interesting thing. So all we have observed, yeah, this is all just a theory about a star being born. All we have observed is just stars blowing up. Again, which makes sense if, you know, there's a universe, maybe there's a time switch, maybe sin. And it might be whatever Adam and Eve did, you know, created the decay of the universe. And the consequences might be far bigger than we could ever imagine. I don't know. I mean, one day in eternity, we will find out. What the fact is so far is we see supernovas every couple of years. And I mean, not often, but evidence is there, and you can go to NASA and they'll give you all the pictures and they show you what they look like. But we've never seen a star coming into creation, yeah, where suddenly there's nothing and the star comes up and it's there. A star is born. Doesn't exist. Okay, that was number 76 and number 77. Okay, so let's have a look at number 77. And it's about the speed of light. And the speed of light is always assumed to be a constant. And there's always a big question, you know, how is it possible if the Earth was created 6,000 years ago and, you know, some of the stuff we see, we assume that they are millions of light years away. Why can we see them? We shouldn't be able to see them if the Earth was created at this time. Or the universe was created at this time, because the light takes so long to travel. I mean, there are a couple of questions we need to ask ourselves. You know, are they really that far away? That's question number one. Nobody really knows. I mean, they talk about blue shift and red shift, and all it comes to, there's a big theory. Then they apply the theory and they run some figures and they come to a conclusion that a star is about a certain distance away. But there are a lot of presumptions in this calculation, and if any of these presumptions isn't right, then the distance isn't right either. So there are a lot of unknown variables, and they just put a value to these unknown variables when they do these calculations, and obviously it's very dangerous to do this. Now, here's the interesting thing is the calculations for the speed of light have been done from the 1700s onwards, and there's always been an amount of error in there. And as time moves on, they got experiments where measuring the speed of light has become more and more precise. Now, when you take the average between the error margin from the speed of light readings from the 1700s all the way to today, what you find is that the speed of light is not a constant. And it's quite scary. So most scientists say they come up with, this is all, you know, balloony, it's a constant, end of story. But the measurements say, and even, you know, the measurements which we've got in the last century, which are fairly precise, they suggest that the speed of light is slowing down. And there's one guy, if you want to search it out or research it a bit more, he's called Satterfield. I've forgotten his first name, is Satterfield. He did some research on this, but you can just go on Google, just get the speed of light measurements. I once did it. I wanted to find it out whether this is real. I'm an RF engineer, radio frequency engineer, and it's sort of close to my heart because there are all sorts of implications. So if the speed of light slows down, it's got an impact on wavelength as well. And if it's got an impact on wavelength, then your antenna resonance has to change. And you can actually measure it, you know, with the wavelength, you know, physical wavelength from, I don't know, 40, 50 years ago to what it is today. But it's obviously, it's depends how you look at this. So I had a personal interest in that. And I was looking at those experiments and the data from these experiments. And I can see, yes, it's true. There is a difference. And the mean average of all these measurements, they seem to suggest that the speed of light is slowing down. Now, when they sort of tried to calculate and, you know, churn a couple of numbers, it looked like the slowdown for the speed of light is like an exponential curve, and it's right at the bottom of the curve where sort of the decay is coming sort of right to the bottom. If you follow this curve and it looks like it's an exponential function, and that 6,000 years ago, the speed of light would have been infinity. Yeah. So it's just an idea. They don't know, obviously. We haven't got the data. All we have is data, reliable data from probably about 100 years, less reliable data from 300 years. And it seems to suggest this. And then obviously you try to, you know, you draw part of the curve on a graph, and then you try to follow it through. And it looks like it's exponential. So if it is exponential, that would suggest that maybe 6,000 years ago, at the time of creation, the speed of light was infinite. If it was infinite, then obviously there wouldn't be the slightest issue. And it's an interesting thing as well. Maybe, you know, the fall of man was so grievous, so severe, that even the speed of life, you know, the constant, was, which might have been a constant being infinite or infinity, would have started slowing down, you know, that even the light was dying. I don't know. It's just an idea. Whether it's true or not, no idea. One day we'll find out, one day when we stand before the great white throne and we will have no more questions. We will know, you know, we will know about these things and about the marvels of creation we have. Right, so that is number 77, and I'm sort of looking at my time here. We are coming out of time. You can go to the website. It's christianwarroom.com, and there are a lot of talks about evolution. I'm going to try to cover about 100 points, 100 ways to kill the theory of evolution. I think it's very important. A lot of youngsters, just a friend of mine, his son came from school, and he was talking about evolution. Christian lad, you know, and he said, yeah, but it's scientific, but it's scientific. So his dad had nothing to say. But we need to fight this battle. So we are running out of time. God bless, you know. Tune in again here at the Christian War Room.
For the past half hour, you've been listening to the Christian War Room with host Michael Sean Bourne. For more information on how you can participate or find out more about the Christian War Room, simply go to christianwarroom.com. That's christianwarroom.com.